This is the Definitely Uncertain podcast, brought to you by Gold Rock Capital. Each week, we look at how high net worth families can improve their lives, decisions, and investments in a deeply uncertain world. We always aim to provide practical information, even if we can't offer specific investment advice.
Hi, welcome to the Definitely Uncertain podcast by Gold Rock Capital. My name is David Ram, and I'm a partner at Gold Rock Capital, the more than 20-year-old multifamily office servicing high net worth investors in Israel and around the world. And with me today is Ahmed Hussein, Global Head of Family Offices at Neuberger Berman. Welcome, Ahmed.
Thank you, David. Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for joining. So the topic of today's conversation is going to be around asset allocation and what the smart single family offices around the world are up to prior to the market volatility and in the market volatility interaction that we're having now. You sit in a great seat because you obviously interact with some of the largest, smartest, well-staffed family offices across the world. But to kickstart, perhaps you can give us a quick background on yourself in more detail and your personal story as well.
Sure. Let me make it quick. So look, I run our global family office business at Neuberger Berman. We are an employee-owned asset manager. We've been around since the 1930s, US-based. And as a firm, we manage about $440 billion or so in assets globally. I look after a family office business, which touches institutional level family offices, people with a billion or more in assets. US and Europe is where our core footprint is, with some family office business in Asia, but we're early there. And in the US, I'd say we touch about 600 family offices. And in Europe, probably about 650, maybe a little bit more than that right now. So we're pretty good breadth of business across all countries, across two big continents. And even in Latin America, we have a big presence. And my journey to this was, I used to be at a firm called Lehman Brothers until 06. Then I was at Goldman from 06 to 2014, doing a range of things. My last job at Goldman was working with hedge funds. And then one of my clients, a pretty well-known Israeli called Patrick Drahi, hired me to be in his family office and manage some money for him. I did that for a couple of years, and then I came to Neuberger Berman to build out their family office practice.
Amazing. Yeah, Neuberger Berman is a firm that at Gold Rock we have a lot of respect for and had a long-standing interaction and relationship with, so that's great. We're big fans. And so now you're in a very unique perspective with Europe and the U.S. How do the typical single family offices that you interact with, what do they think about asset allocation? How much do they respect that? Because obviously asset allocation has always been cited, at least in academia, as one of the most important, probably the largest driver of returns and risk management across portfolios for the long term. So how does a typical client of yours think about that?
Yeah, one of the reasons I, after having worked with insurance companies, pension companies, banks, hedge funds, for various investment banks, the reason I moved over to the family office part of our business was, even though the dollar amounts are smaller and the clients are smaller, I would say that I wanted to cover this client base because family offices have the ability to do anything, to do everything. Mm. And they want to be around in 50 years and 100 years time, and they want to be multi-generational. And so that leads to certain types of behaviors. And so they're a super interesting client base to be around. And I've had the opportunity to be around them since 2009. And, you know, what I've seen on the asset allocation front is a range of things, and there's a spectrum, right? And so there are the family offices who've been around for maybe second or third generation. They have, might be maybe a consultant involved. They definitely have a benchmark. Their benchmark might be CPI plus 3, RPI plus 5, or 60-40 portfolio. And once you have a benchmark, then you need to start thinking about asset allocation, because you need to think about, how am I going to beat my benchmark? But I would say for a client base, only 30 to 40% have a benchmark and have an asset allocation model. 60% don't. They may think about stuff on a macro basis, so they may be still top down in some format. But for the most part, a lot of family offices are still bottoms up, especially if you're first generation, the person who made the money is still involved. They have their own network. They have their own biases. They have their own industry that they maybe made the money in. And so a lot of the what they do and what they see and what they believe is driven by that person's belief. Because after all, and I focus mostly on our single family office business, all of those billionaires have come up and made their wealth in a specific industry. And so they know that thing really well, and they have a network in that. And so a lot of what that leads to is just a bottoms up behavior as opposed to a top down asset allocation macro framework. And there's sort of a continuum. There's clients with the consultants and the benchmarks. And then there's a newer, more entrepreneurial money that's more high net worth. And it was just, I want to make money. Don't show me any ideas that are going to basically just send me stuff that's going to make me money. I don't want to talk about model or model portfolios or a strategic asset allocation. Just send me ideas that are going to make me money. Keep it simple. I don't want to really have time for any of the details. And so that's what we see in our world.
That's interesting. And those two sides of the story, the 30, 40%, that's a much smaller number than I was anticipating, to be honest, that focuses on asset allocation. Does the liquidity, the lack of need for active liquidity all the time in these large billion-dollar plus single family offices, does that drive also the difference in view of asset allocation? In other words, their ability to do whatever they want to do in a private market format as well is quite substantial, as opposed to saying, okay, it's going to be a stocks and bonds portfolio, all liquid, and then perhaps asset allocation may make a lot more sense and a way to express your perspective in the market. But when you can do direct lending, real estate, whatever they're doing, does that change the calculus?
Yeah, I think it changes the calculus in a number of ways. It makes things harder. It makes things easier, right? It makes it harder because usually a family office would say a billion, even 3 billion might be four or five guys, women sitting in a room trying to do everything. You're trying to do real estate and you're trying to do credit and you're trying to do public and you're trying to do private and you're trying to do some cash management. And boy, that's a lot of stuff to do. So the first question for most of these people is, am I going to be doing direct investing? And a lot of people like doing direct deals. Or am I going to be an allocator? Am I going to find managers? Am I going to find people to give my money to, or am I going to go do this myself? So that's question one, because obviously the hard part is that you're having to deal with a lot of assets with very few people, and you don't have people who are specialists in one thing. You have people who know how to do a lot of things. And a lot of people are attracted to family office jobs because it gives them the breadth to do a lot of things as opposed to quite a narrow niche job, which is quite typical in finance. Now that is the negative. The positive obviously is what you said, which is around, if it's not working in stocks and bonds, you can go do stuff over in private markets, right?
Right.
And that's where in the last decade, probably we've seen clients move quite heavily from being in hedge funds in the 90s or 2000s, or being just in stocks or long only, to transition more and more of their portfolios to private markets. And private markets made sense for clients because, as you said, they don't have a need for money immediately. They don't need liquidity. Of course, people need to figure out what their outflows will be, what their expenses are, any other ways that cash is going out, maybe for philanthropic reasons. But for the most part, you needed to figure out, okay, I need to compound at 7, 8, 9%, maybe more than that. How am I going to go do that? And if I look at Neuberger's capital market assumptions, and we can share these with people, we think over the next 10 years, S&P is probably going to do somewhere between 5 and 6%. And we think private equity is probably going to do somewhere between 8 to 10%. Now, if you're kind of like, well, I still want to earn as high a return as possible, you need to be in private equity in some format. And fixed income is going to be probably closer to 3 or 4%, if not lower. And so what has happened in the last decade is that more and more people have said, okay, why don't I do US private equity? Returns are higher and returns have been great. It takes away the mark-to-market ball, make sure that I don't do anything stupid like selling at the bottom or buying at the top. So I just have a continuous re-up program, managers I trust, and I can compound in the mid-teens returns. And that sort of worked out well for people. And I see clients continuing to do that. And I think we take that even further. What you're seeing clients do now is do things. One of the great things about being a family office is, as you said, you can do anything. You're not defined to stocks and bonds. And the other great thing is that it's not like you're looking after 300 billion or 400 billion like a corporate pension. You're looking after maybe 1 billion on the small side, or maybe a bigger client might be 10 or 15 billion on the big side. So you can do quite niche things. You can do insurance-linked securities. You can do music royalties. You can do life settlements. You can do venture capital. You can write the $10 to $50 million check that just wouldn't matter for a bigger client. And they have been smart about using some of those niches to pick up alpha. And then I think family offices also get that they might not have a lot of inflows. A lot of family offices, if they're on second or third generation, there's no other liquidity event coming. There's no more money coming in. The portfolio is what the portfolio is. And that's quite different from a pension fund or some other investor. Even a hedge fund might see inflows. There's no inflow potentially coming into a family office. And so these people have been trained to manage their cash. They usually run a lot of liquidity. I've had clients who've been sitting on 30% cash for many years, waiting for a sell-off. And some of that was deployed in things like 2020, and some of it's being deployed again. So family offices run their portfolio quite nimbly, quite tactically, and quite positioned to survive. These are not people that take on a lot of leverage. And I think they're trying to use their permanent capital to do these niche things, but portfolios have definitely moved to the illiquid side in the last 10, 15 years.
Yeah, I think from our perspective as well, just on the last point you made around not a lot of money is coming in, rather money is going out. We look at it, one of my clients calls it a melting ice cube. You have not a lot of money coming in, a lot more money actually leaving the system. And on top of that, the inflationary issues that are happening that we see as well, which shrinks the valuation quite substantially. So when you look at those different kinds of family offices that you work with, because just a bit of inside baseball into Gold Rock, we used to be a single family office and we became a multi in 2013. And in earlier days, we were very much opportunistic, manager driven. We didn't really think about the equity markets as much. And frankly, in up markets, it hurt us a little bit, because you're generating, let's call it 7-8% a year. And most managers, while the markets are doing double digits, and that doesn't always help, because you want to make sure you keep ahead of the curve so you can have some drawdown tolerance. So when you're looking at the current market volatility and you're looking at the different types of families that you work with, who's complaining more, right? The guys who are the asset allocator, more academic models that you see, like the 30-40% you mentioned, or the guys who are much more opportunistic, manager driven, and less focused on asset allocation? Who's complaining more when you see a 20%+ market drawdown? Because obviously in the good markets, I'm sure asset allocators may have done well, but today it feels quite difficult when you have a large liquid exposure.
Yeah, I would say the answer to that is most family offices ran themselves pretty conservatively, as I mentioned earlier. And so I'm not hearing or feeling a lot of pain. I think the pain has been more idiosyncratic in the sense of, say, somebody made their money originally in technology and they really thought technology was great. And for the last 10 years, that was the place to be. And so over the last 10 years, what they might have done is over allocate to tech because, hey, I know it and hey, it's working. And so before it, you're levered long Facebook, Netflix, and you're overcommitted to various VC firms, which feels great even in 2020 because of the markups. And then now you're starting to get a little bit worried and maybe you're getting margin calls. So I think the people who have gotten into trouble are people who have over-indexed to particular industries, whether it's tech more recently or in 2020 when oil collapsed, or in 2014 when oil collapsed, people who were more over-indexed to that. And so I think people are learning that, hey, we can't just be bottoms up and we can't just be like, hey, somebody heard something at a cocktail party and this looks like a cool idea, let's do it. Like, we probably should have some structure or process. So I have a diversified portfolio, and people are thinking more about factor risk and their exposures. And maybe I have too much EM frontier in my portfolio. And so portfolios have definitely become much more immune and more anti-fragile than they have been. But I think, Ned, yeah, the people who are feeling more pain are the ones who didn't have a good asset allocation process. It didn't have to be formal. It just had to be like, let's look at my overall exposure on a look-through basis and see, maybe I have too much of one thing. And by the way, what's happened more recently is a lot of people in the last 5-6 years over-indexed to quality and durable growth and the quality factor. And quality factor meant that these were high-quality businesses that ended up trading at 25, 35 times earnings. And now when rates are going up, all of these businesses are being derated. And so you didn't have to actually even do a bad thing. You could have just been like, I want to be long quality businesses. And it turns out even being long quality businesses, too much of that can be a bad thing, because all of your portfolio can go down at the same time when rates move. And so I think people, you need to be diversified and be positioned to survive across different market cycles and environments. whether it's stagflation and whether it's deflationary growth. But I think the family office community net has gotten that message. So we don't feel a lot of pain. I think just to continue on what the point you made, places where there might be some pain longer term is, at least in Europe and in the US, most people's portfolios are over-indexed to US exposure. Yeah. Because Europeans didn't want to be long European assets. And EM was like, hey, we've seen that crisis before. So I would say a typical family office is 80 to 90% US assets. And in that world, they're probably also unhedging. They are not hedging the US dollar. Because historically, when there's a market correction, dollar goes up, as we've seen recently. And so your portfolio hedges itself. And so I think one thing that we talk about with clients is, what's your overall exposure to the US economy? And are you over indexed to that?
Interesting. Yeah, because obviously, we think about asset allocation, the two issues that we really often focus in on relates to liquidity and correlation. So you've been speaking a lot about correlations now, over indexing to either US tech or other markets that maybe real estate is oftentimes in a single family office format, and over indexed to real estate oftentimes as well. And when it works for over a decade, it feels good. And then all of a sudden you can get hit because there's a very high correlation across the vast majority of your portfolio. But what we've seen, and you've been doing this for over a decade as well, what we've seen is that correlations have been quite high across a lot of asset classes. So think about growth versus value, or tech versus real estate, or various currencies you mentioned. It seems a lot of it's been correlated to the upside and to the downside. So how does that factor into the worry or the focus in on doing an asset allocation to ensure that you have different types of assets, different types of regions, different types of currencies, when what we've seen, I think at least what we've seen a lot, is very high correlations across all asset classes? Maybe now we're seeing some decoupling and we'll see if that continues. But what's your view on that?
And by view, you mean, what do we think about?
Well, first of all, do you agree? Maybe I completely misdiagnosed the whole issue. That's completely fine as well. But in terms of the correlation aspects, I'll give you an example. Bonds and equities both go up and down in tandem for well over a decade. Maybe now it seems we may see a decoupling there, but it didn't make a lot of sense to have fixed income or income strategies when the correlation between equity and income was so high.
Yeah.
And the upside on equity is so much more meaningful and the tax rates are so much lower. So why have income strategies when it's correlated to equity strategies anyway? I just pour it all into equity. So a lot of allocators actually were pushing to have a much higher allocation to equity strategies, like a 70-30 or 80-20 versus a 60-40, for example, over the past decade, because what's the point in having such a large income orientation when the correlations are high anyway?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think a lot of people went all in on saying, hey, inflation is an issue, or rates are so low, I shouldn't hold any bonds because rates are so low, or why own commodities because look, commodity prices keep going down all the time. So I think that has definitely been an issue in people's portfolios.
That's a great point. Commodities has been on a downward slope for many years. So it adds value from a asset allocation perspective because you're crushing it on the equity side and you're losing money on a commodity. So you're down. But is that a worthwhile strategy? You look the past year or so, you could say, oh, we're finally getting paid off on commodities and perhaps bonds are decoupling from the correlations to equity. But that's only now. We've had 15 years of the opposite. So how are people thinking about that when they position their portfolios today?
Yeah, so I would say there's sort of a couple of questions that people are asking to go down the school of thought that you've highlighted. How do I build portfolios for a world with more inflation and higher vol than I'm used to in the last two decades? Yeah. We had a particular world in which vol was generally falling. VIX was below 10, 15, rates were low and going down. And now vol stays high, and not just VIX, but literally your portfolio bars have gone up and inflation is persistent, right? And so we just did I would say it's not statistically accurate, but we went and asked a bunch of our clients and said, hey, where do you think the CPI, US CPI headline inflation will be at the end of 2023? And a lot of them came back with that number is going to be between 5 and 6% next year. So that's a long time from now. And that's high. And I'm like, look, in that world, where do you think rates are where do you think treasuries are? And so that's one school of thought. And then there's another school of thought of clients which said, look, we're obviously going into a recession in the US. Fed's tightening so high, you can see the consumer is starting to feel pain. And actually, it's a great time to buy you treasuries because rates are about to go down. And in black, we've seen the peak in rates. And that's another school of thought. And I just say that to 50, 60% of clients are like, inflation is high and persistent. And another is like, the economy is about to collapse and we're about to have deflation again. And that kind of, when you have that bipolar market behavior, obviously you're going to feel volatility because both of these sides are going to be pulling. So that's an overall bigger question. And so what that then leads to is other questions are, when does inflation normalize? And so everybody's having to consider this, where do I think US inflation will be? Because inflation will then determine rates, and rates will then determine currencies and will determine commodities. So that's a big question. And if you think rates are going to start coming off, then it's probably a good time to buy bonds. If you think inflation will stay high and go higher, then you probably still want to keep adding to commodities. And so we were talking to a client recently who has given us a multi-asset mandate. And so we were talking about how to think about their portfolio. And they want to compound at 8-9%. And so we're going to transition their portfolio more and more into private markets. And they're okay with being 30-40% in private markets to get to their return goals, because it's probably hard to get to 8+% just being in public markets. So as an anecdote, I'll tell you how we've thought about their portfolio, right? How we've constructed their portfolio to see how we're changing. And so initially we came in January or late last year, we would have had something like 50% of their portfolio in equities, a range of equities, everything from European, US, global, systematic strategy, some put writing, things like that.
All liquid, you mean?
All liquid, sort of daily liquidity, equity strategies, some thematic ideas, but broad range of things. We would have taken their equity at 50%. And at the beginning of this year, we said, okay, we think we're in a bit of a phase change, a bit of a regime change. So we took their equity exposure from 50 to 35. Their fixed income, we came into the year at about 30-32% fixed income exposure, opportunistic credit, global bonds, a pretty broad mandate. So not IG or high yield or EM, but like a broad sort of very opportunistic mandate. And we've kept that at 30-32%. We haven't really changed that. So what we've done is, and I think a lot of people don't use this in their portfolios, is we had liquid alternatives, which we had about 15% of the portfolio, and we took that up to about 30% of the portfolio. And what that includes, and I think a lot of clients are thinking about this, that includes everything from absolute return hedge funds, uncorrelated strategies, StatR, RelVal, things like that. It includes some real assets, so some real estate type stuff, some commodities. So maybe real estate is 5%, maybe commodities is 5% of that. Maybe some macro is about 10% of that. And so we've tried to create some diversifiers overall. Yep. in people's portfolios that are a little bit uncorrelated with the direction of the market.
Interesting.
Give you some ballast. And so those are the changes we made in Jan, Feb, and that stabilized people's portfolios and allowed them to suffer a lot less than what a 60-40 portfolio has done, which has had a horrible start to 2022.
Yeah, completely. Yeah. You've mentioned a couple of things, which is actually quite interesting, because hedge funds, for example, have been completely out of favor. I'm not sure if this is the time to talk about specifics, but it's interesting that you mentioned that you increased meaningfully more alternative investment strategies in the hedge fund space, which has been really out of favor. And you also mentioned something earlier, which is that your view on private equity is the return profile will be 8-10 annualized, which is probably going to challenge the hurdle rate a little bit on how that looks for a lot of those guys. We have some money in the secondary markets in private equity. And one of the things that we always find interesting is that the calculations that you make on the hurdle rates when you're buying up portfolios, because that's the most critical aspect around if there's carry or not carry. So I wonder if that's actually going to be pushing against the alternative manager. I'm sure guys like a Dial at Neuberger Berman can provide more information about their expectations around that. But those are two very interesting changes that you've mentioned in terms of hedge funds and private markets. One other aspect around liquidity I wanted to touch on before we move on, which is, because I mentioned liquidity and correlations are the two key elements around, at least from our perspective, around asset allocation. How important is liquidity, even to billion-dollar long-term investor-oriented single-family offices that you work with? Is a liquidity profile an important element in how they construct their portfolios? Or is there tolerance for long-term private market, private real estate, private corporate very high because maybe their horizon is 20-30 years?
Yeah, I think that's something that clients have been thinking about over the last 4 or 5 years as they increase their illiquids. Obviously, you had the question of, okay, slowly more and more my portfolio is becoming locked up, tied up, and I need to think about what that means. And I think things have gotten a little bit worse recently in the sense that there were distributions that people thought were going to come, but then actually the market sold off. So some of the distributions didn't come, funds extended, PE firms decided to hold on to assets a little bit longer than distributing them. Some people came back for re-ups more than they expected, or you met a new manager that you were excited about. You're like, okay, things are looking good in private markets. So people, again, over-indexed, over-allocated to private markets a little more than expected. And so I think there's a little bit of a thought now that I see from clients is like, okay, maybe 2022 is the year we just sit and wait or look for more shorter duration private strategies. Still like the return profile of private strategies, but maybe I have enough long duration in my portfolio, so I need to do shorter duration to private markets, for example, secondaries or maybe private debt or something like that. And so that's where people's head is at. But I think, again, having been through the 08 crisis, and most of the people we work with have been around even before that or since 2000, they've seen these crises before. And I think the 08 event was quite a brain changer psychologically for people, because they saw even hedge funds, which they thought were quarterly liquidity products, put them in side pockets, lock people up. And so people have appreciated liquidity a lot more since then. And they have felt the need to survive and be around longer term, as most of these families are 20, 30, 100 years old. And so a lot of family offices are now set up to survive and don't have to do anything forced, except some of the people I mentioned to you earlier who maybe were over-indexed to technology and found themselves,
yeah,
whole portfolio is down 30, 40%. I probably need to create liquidity, not because I need money for something, but because I'm just tired of my net worth being chipped away 5% every day. So let's stop the pain, let's stop the bleed. But I'm happy to say that across our wide net of clients, 600, like I said, in Europe, nobody's really had, oh my God, I don't have enough liquidity on hand. People were smart. They set up credit lines through different banks. They maybe moved some of their positions from straight up equity to swaps. So people came in well positioned. And clients, for the most part, when they make private market mandates, there's multiple ways of thinking, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, is I just committed $100 million to a private equity fund. Do I hold all the $100 million in cash from today for all the future capital calls? Or will I fund some of that from future distributions from other funds? Or do I sell my equities over time? So again, I think Europeans, for the most part, run that game quite conservatively. They hold their liquidity tight because, again, they know that no new money is going to come in to rescue them.
That last question is a really interesting question. It's a question that we often deal with, especially when we bring on a new client that perhaps does not have a lot in private markets, and then we'll start building up a portfolio, which can take 5, 6 years more to get to an allocation and to exposure in which it's more of a natural phenomenon where distributions can now fund future capital calls more or less. And to sit on cash, at least the past decade plus, has been a terrible idea, waiting around for the capital calls. But to put it into high vol, high returning strategies like the liquid markets is also difficult, because you don't want to have a situation in which you come into a drawdown period and you get a lot of capital calls. I think the point in time where we got the most capital calls by far across all of our strategies was March 2020. March 2020, the equity markets was down 35%, and every single strategy that we have money with, distressed, private lending, private equity, venture capital, real estate, everyone was calling capital. And they were all calling capital because they were either delevering or they were taking advantage across their strategy. So I'm happy to say we've been very conscious of liquidity, and I would say low vol liquidity, whether it's cash or very low vol, in order to ensure that we can answer those capital calls and not have a problem. And we also have a number of clients with those credit lines in place as well, just in case they don't have to liquidate directional liquid equity when it's down 35% to answer a capital call in distressed debt. So you don't want to do that. So that's how we've done it, but it's been a challenge because liquidity is, I always found it's over, we have an over amount of liquidity typically. And that means our private markets is less than I would like oftentimes across clients, because I see that outperformance quite substantially similar to what you've seen as well. And I also see better opportunities for negatively correlated asset classes like real estate as a great example, where we can do real estate in different parts. And I can't really do real estate effectively in a liquid format. In conclusion, just coming to the end around what we're trying to see now, and we're trying to play in this very volatile, very challenging market environment. We haven't seen it yet in private markets. We haven't seen those NAV numbers coming through. We'll see what happens in Q2. But Q1, I can tell you from our side, at least, was quite positive, which is, you know, questions whether they're valuing the assets appropriately or not. But Q2, we'll have to see what happens with Q2. But if you have a couple of tips you can give to the high net worth community around what's happening today, either an idea around an investment idea or an approach around managing the portfolios, what would be your top 1-2 tips that you could provide the high net worth community in this crazy world we're living in today, especially with the inflation that you mentioned earlier and rates changing, et cetera?
I think rather than pitching an investment idea, I would pitch a book. I'm a big reader, and I think you are too. And I would say the book that is appropriate for this time is probably, it's called The Psychology of Money by a guy called Morgan Housel, who's a great writer, and it's a great book. And I'm sure people have read some of his articles. And from his book, I think the most interesting idea was this idea of survival, to get rich, to compound. And on my LinkedIn profile, as you pointed out, I had a chart of what could $1 become over 30 years if you compounded at different rates. And all of that's fine. But I think most of your listeners probably know, if you look at somebody like Buffett's net worth, 95% of his net worth, what he made, came after the age of 65, which is, wait, are you serious? Like, he made 95% of his wealth after the age of 65. And that's true, because he just kept compounding. And the difference between a Warren Buffett versus anybody else who's worth a couple hundred million is that he just kept going. And so if you want to be wealthy, and if you want to do well in life, you got to keep going. And so to keep going, you have to survive and not get taken out. And so I kind of take that survival idea, which means you need to build enough margin of safety in your life, which means you need to use the Nassim Taleb concept of be anti-fragile. And so when things like today are happening, how were you constructed as a human being psychologically, as your portfolio, that you actually get stronger when the world starts shaking? So make sure you have margin of safety in your life, in your portfolio, in everything that you do, and be anti-fragile. And then I think the second big idea, and I've had to deal with this myself over time, having been in finance, is understand what the money is for. I'm sure you and I have both seen many people who are rich, but they're not really free. And so you have to decide, what is the money for? Is it for status? Is it for bragging rights? Is it for things, or is it to be free? And there's no point being rich but not being free psychologically, because you're worried about, you're looking at your portfolio every hour, every minute, wondering how things are going. And so that's the other thing I talk to people about. Construct your life so you don't have to stress out, because there's no point being worth a couple hundred million and then stressing out all the time and having high blood pressure and cholesterol. So
that's fantastic. There's a Jewish saying that who is a rich man is somebody who is happy with his lot. He's happy with what he has. He's happy with his life, with his thinking, with his approach. Not somebody who has lots of money, because someone who has lots of money could be not rich if you don't know what it's for. I think that's a great tip. And besides for your LinkedIn profile with that picture in the background of compounding interest, which I found to be very interesting, because obviously, as you pointed out, it happens much more later on. If you compound at 7.5% a year, in year 20 and 30 and 40, like Warren Buffett felt, I guess that's where you really start feeling the effects of compound interest, as Einstein says, the most powerful force in the universe. Besides for that, Ahmed, besides for LinkedIn, where can people find you? How can people learn more about what you're up to? Is that the best place to find, to speak to you, to reach out to you, to learn about what you're up to?
Ping me on LinkedIn. We're very reachable. We have people in every country in Europe, every city in the US that can come and be helpful to you guys. My email address is m@hussein@nb.com. So reach out if you want to talk about anything, if we can be helpful to you or your clients in any way.
Ahmed, thanks so much for your time. Great conversation. Turbulent times ahead, probably. So hold on tight. And sounds like you're doing a great job. So thank you so much. And thanks to everyone for listening to the Gold Rock podcast. And we'll see you next time.